I'm going to call the public hearing of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means to order. This is a subcommittee of one of the subcommittee. We have members that are coming, and Representative Butler will be joining us at 2. He's otherwise occupied. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 5012. We carried that over from hearing from yesterday. Phil, you're here today, and I know that Senator George is in his way, and we're trying to track down the rest of the members. So, do you want to go ahead and do you want to introduce, or do you want me to
cover briefly what we gave you?
Sure.
Yesterday.
Well, why don't we? Yeah, go ahead, and hopefully some people will get here before people testify.
Mr. Chair and member, and staff.
And staff.
Thank you. We have distributed a packet of information that responds to your request from yesterday. I've attached a cover memo, and there's a substantial packet of information. I want to just briefly go through and tell you what's there. First question was counties that are not submitting their sentencing guidelines reports. As I mentioned yesterday, there are 5 counties who do not do that. That represents about 1,400 reports, or roughly 9% of what we would expect on a statewide total basis. We did send letters in May of 2000 to the DAs in all. At that time, there were 8 non-reporting counties. We got positive responses and are now getting guidelines reports from 3 of them. We have not raised the issue formally since that time, either with the DAs or their elected successors or with the presiding judges in those judicial districts. So that's the status report on the non-reporting counties. You also asked for additional information on programs funded with the JCP prevention funds. You have in your packet a 1-page summary by county that shows, in general terms, what the programs and proposed outcomes for each county are, and also the amount of money both in the OIA funds, which are basic services and diversion, and the prevention funds from the Criminal Justice Commission. I would just note for you that these are based on the amounts approved in the legislatively adopted budget, the close of session budget, and as we discussed yesterday, those amounts have been substantially reduced by special session, and so what is going on in the counties right now will be different than what you see here on this paper, but you can see where we started out and what the counties were doing. The next handout is a summary by category of how the juvenile crime prevention plans are spent. So, for example, you can see that there is a category of courts and juries, which include peer courts, peer juries, teen courts, sanction courts. There's a substantial amount of funding in family services, which is the functional family functional therapy, which is one of the blueprint programs, as well as some of the other services that, again, go on the risk factor of poor family functioning. You'll see about $3.4 million in school-related services, including school programs, court school, transitional, boys and girls clubs, mentoring. And so that will give you kind of a different look on a categorical basis. The last question was information about youth population in counties and the population of tribal youth. The first page there is entitled Oregon Youth Under 18 by County. That is based on the Portland State University estimate that we use to allocate these funds. And again, it takes approximately about 4,000 youth is where you get into the population distribution. We do have minimum grants that currently go to 8 counties that are minimum grant jurisdictions, as we discussed yesterday. The estimating the number of tribal youth is very problematic. We have several different data sources, and the information we get from those different data sources are dramatically different. And so I've given you 2 pages of information from the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. The first shows where the tribes are located, whether they have reservations or former reservations, whether they are federally recognized or not, and what their enrolled tribal populations are. The second table, which again shows a statewide map and is shown by counties, shows you the Indian population by county. That reflects people who may not are Indian, who may not be enrolled members of tribes that are located in Oregon. They may be Native Americans, but not affiliated, much less enrolled, with the tribe that's in Oregon. So that's a brief run through of your questions from yesterday and our responses, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks, Phil.
Questions?
Gary just got here. George, we went over the memo that okay. Phil provided with a list of information from questions that were raised yesterday during the course of the hearing. And we have several individuals who are here to testify today on behalf of the Criminal Justice Commission in regard to House Bill 5012. So, Phil, is there anything you'd like to add before we get public testimony?
I just want to say, especially for Senator George's benefit, that I was not responsible for having the two teenagers outside yesterday, nor am I responsible for this group outside today.
You saw me.
So I just want to... what I have for you today, Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I'd like to introduce Linda Wagner, who is a member of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee. She is the chair of the Evaluation Subcommittee and a researcher in the Lane County Juvenile Department. She is, I think, going to give you a very general summary of what the research shows in terms of what works in preventing juvenile crime. And then we'll introduce our evaluation team, Jeff Sprague from the University of Oregon and Juliet Mackin from NPC Research. They are the two bodies that we have contracts with to do that, and they will present the evaluation findings thus far. We then have a group of other people interested in providing you with some testimony, David Fullerton from the Grand Ronde Tribe. We have two juvenile directors, Joe Christie from Washington County and Larry Oglesby from Marion County. Joanne Miller is the director of the Benton County Commission on Children and Families, and Billy Wasson is a retired corrections administrator here from Marion County who is on the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee.
Thanks, so, Phil. With that, I will, just so the audience knows, normally we sit a little differently around this table. We're doing the public safety priorities, as some of you may well be aware this afternoon. We're going to do them in a little more dynamic fashion. So the chair is over here by the laptop computer in order to manipulate part of those priorities as we move further along. So I apologize for the odd configuration of our hearing room today. We don't always act quite this strange.
Mr. Chair, I thought it was just a dramatic shift to the left on your
part. Right.
Well, does that mean you moved to the right, Representative Hanson? Because normally you sit over here. So
it depends whether you're facing or looking away.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I assume this might be a hostile audience based upon the numbers, and so you're going to let me take the
floor. That's all right.
Mr. Chair, if it would be helpful to the committee that if Phil didn't read your name off for public testimony and you want to testify on this budget, there should be a sign-up sheet over on the table. We'd appreciate it if you could sign up. We are going to try to close down testimony at 2 o'clock for the other item on the agenda.
All right. With those thoughts in mind, Linda, go ahead and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Linda Wagner, researcher for the Lane County Juvenile Department, a non-hostile researcher. And I very much appreciate your time today and being able to meet with you. Our chair of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, JCPAC, Lane County Commissioner Bobby Green, asked me to respectfully send his regrets that he himself could not be here today. You got the fifth string instead by sending myself. But he did send a letter in support of JCP, and that has been handed out to each of you. I am not going to take this brief time with you because I want to allow as much time for the JCP evaluation as possible to actually read that letter verbatim. Instead, what I'd like to do as a way of introduction is just present some of the highlights to you and then turn it over to the independent researchers. What we know is that over 40 years of research has gone into identifying effective strategies that prevent and reduce juvenile crime. And JCP operationalizes that research by doing a couple things. One, it targets high-risk youth, those at high risk to ever commit their first crime, or for early offenders, those at risk of becoming chronic. Two, it utilizes evidence-based principles, strategies, and programs to reduce the likelihood that they do commit those crimes. And three, it has required outcome measures for the accountability and to make sure it is working with the intent that it is supposed to work, which is the overall goal of preventing victimization of juvenile crime in our state. Now, at the risk, and if you'll indulge me for a moment in taking this risk of overstating the obvious, we know that it is imperative that public funds are used wisely. And by that I mean, for the investment, you get the biggest return on that investment. So the JCP return, unquote, is preventing that victimization. And as stewards of that charge, we are accountable for the outcome through this independent evaluation. I feel very proud to introduce the evaluators. They represent two different groups that could have competed for this task, but chose instead to work together as a team in analyzing and conducting the evaluation, in working with counties and the tribal communities to develop the evaluation plan in a thoughtful, rigorous manner. And those two organizations represent the University of Oregon Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior, which is the lead evaluator, and the principal evaluator who is here today is Dr. Jeff Sprague, who is director of the Institute. We also have Dr. Juliet Mackin with the Northwest Professional Consortium, the other agency research entity who has been conducting the evaluation. As Phil said, as chair of the evaluation subgroup, I've had the pleasure of meeting with them monthly, in addition to other JCPAC members, to watch and look at and monitor the progress of the evaluation. And I certainly don't want to take away their thunder or moment in the presentation here, but I will say, in looking at the evaluation, that the JCP investment has accomplished and is meeting that expected return. That is, it's identifying the right kids, providing good services, and preventing and reducing juvenile crime, in addition to lowering the risk factors, which place these high-risk kids at increased jeopardy of acting out and delinquent behavior. With that statement, very broad statement on the evaluation, I'm going to turn it over to the evaluators to provide you with the details and background and further information on the evaluation. Again, Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And we do have handouts. If you take a moment and give handouts on the slides themselves. I think because of the setup here, Chair Patrick, they will need to stand there in order to view the PowerPoint.
Yeah,
and we'll move the mic over.
Okay. You can beep or something now.
You have the button.
Ever had rock stars?
That's right. Yeah, I bet we won't be able to sit down. We can stand in front of us.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Representative Patridge and members of the committee, I'm going to start off giving a little background on the JCP evaluation and then turn it over to my colleague, Juliet Mackin, who will talk about some of the outcomes, and then I'll bring myself back to talk about what we call the high-level outcomes or data relative to youth arrest. And thank you for the opportunity to...
Craig, can you
yes.
just, for the record, say your name? So
sure.
So you're for all history when somebody comes back to review this tape.
Okay, thank
you.
We'll
hold you accountable.
Well, in that case...
your name won't be changed.
That's right. Jeff Sprague from the University of Oregon. So basically, Linda, and if you can follow along with the slides at your pleasure, briefly, the purpose of the JCP project and legislation was to prevent and reduce juvenile crime in the state utilizing research and evidence-based practices. Basically, the enabling legislation of Senate Bill 555 required that programs target youth with the five so-called risk factors listed there: antisocial behavior, poor family functioning, failure in school, substance abuse problems, and negative peer association. These are very robust indicators of juvenile crime and very appropriate targets for intervention. A few things that we know we may be looking, for example, a so-called silver bullet, the one risk factor that would define or help us predict who these young people are. The reality is that each youth tends to be very individual, and what's a better indicator is the actual number, the total number of risk that's presented by a youth. And so by targeting multiple risk factors, as you'll see, we also can see some evidence that the JCP programs are targeting the right youth. As Linda also said, we believe that the JCP approach is working. As researchers, of course, that's always a guarded working, and would leave many of those to your judgment as well. But I think the approach of working to reduce risk factors and increase protection or skills for youth appear to be having the results that we would hope them to have in this regard. In order to participate in JCP programs, the youth must have multiple risk factors, and you'll be able to see in a moment from the data what those risk factors look like. Each community, each county has developed a different mix of programs within guidelines set by the JCPAC and include direct interventions and other services such as case management and work with families to help them get stable. In terms of the research, again, I think Linda did as good a job as anyone could do. There are multiple studies, many of which, by the way, were even conducted in our own state by the Oregon Social Learning Center and my colleague Hill Walker at the University of Oregon. But both nationally and internationally, we see very similar findings in predicted outcome based on the prevention programs that are funded through this legislation. The open question to this point is much of the research we have has been conducted by researchers under highly controlled conditions. We now see across the country a move to replicate and scale up, if you will, research validated and evidence-based programs. So with a focus on quality of the implementation as opposed to detailed sort of hair-splitting research, which is very expensive and would ultimately take away from the funds available to serve youth. So basically the background is done, and in the JCP model, basic and high-risk prevention services are provided. The basic services are provided by OYA, and we won't be addressing those today, but specifically the JCP prevention programs. Again, all 36 counties are participating along with tribal participation, and each community, each provider is providing a different mix based on what their local needs assessment of youth. So that's the background. I'm going to now turn it over to my colleague Juliet, and she'll continue.
Thank you. My name is Juliet Mackin, for the record, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you very much. Youth who are at risk for juvenile delinquency are identified in the evaluation and in the JCP programs by a validated risk assessment tool. And you'll see on the far the upper left box that's highlighted is where those youth are identified by the assessment. That's also considered time one for the evaluation. We measure their risk factors or their risk indicators at time one and at a follow-up time period as well. Youth with indicators, as Jeff mentioned, in two or more of the domains become eligible for the high-risk prevention services, and that's where the JCP interventions occur in the middle top box. Moving to the right, we have intermediate outcomes, and those are where we measure again for time two whether those risk indicators have decreased and whether protective factors have increased. As we said before, the interventions target one or more risks with the goal of eliminating them or in building those positive factors. We also know that the reductions in risk factors or the reductions in risk indicators contribute to the goal of JCP's high-level outcomes, which are to reduce recidivism, to reduce juvenile arrests, et cetera. High-level outcomes on the bottom of this chart, reducing juvenile arrests and staying within the OYA bed limit are benchmarks that are related to the Oregon Youth Authority. The second measure here, reducing juvenile recidivism, is really what we focused on in the evaluation, and Jeff will be talking about that in a few minutes to describe the results that we have in that area. JCP interventions target risk indicators for juvenile crime, risk factors for juvenile crime. We've put some examples together here so you can see the types of programs that are being funded by JCP high-risk prevention dollars. As both Linda and Jeff have mentioned, these are programs that have been demonstrated to be effective in reducing risk indicators that put youth at high risk for delinquency. In addition to those specific interventions, each county also has a plan where it identifies mechanisms for ensuring cultural appropriate service and gender appropriate services. We want to mention as part of the evaluation findings that JCP is reaching the right youth. We are targeting youth at high risk of delinquency, and as we mentioned, eligibility indicates that they have to have risk indicators in at least two risk domains. The youth in JCP have an average of three, so they are exceeding the minimum eligibility requirement for the JCP. Having higher numbers of risk domains puts a youth at increased risk. The more risk domains, the higher the risk of delinquency. This is a description of who's being served. We have about two-thirds of the JCP participants are males. Our average age is 14. The target range for JCP is the 10 to 17 age group. We do have a county that received a waiver for prevention services for younger youth, and counties do have that option for specific youth to look at younger kids. But we have that average age about 14, and the race and ethnicity is provided here for groups of kids, generally approximating Oregon's youth population. As we said earlier, this eligibility requires two risk domains, and we have JCP youth with an average of three. Within each of those risk domains, there are multiple indicators. So, for example, within the area of school, youth may have school academic failure, they may have dropped out, they may have chronic truancy issues. So there are multiple ways that we measure a particular domain. And we find that youth within JCP not only have risks that are across domains, but also have multiple issues within each area. Another complicating factor for many of these young people is issues with mental health. We certainly are seeing in this particular group over one in four young people having a serious mental health issue. This next slide describes the number of risk domains that JCP youth have. In this particular description, you'll see that over three-quarters of the youth in JCP have more than the required minimum number of risk domains. And this description doesn't specify which of those domains they have. It's just the total number. So they may have, in the area where they have two risk domains, they may have antisocial behavior and poor family functioning or substance abuse and failure in school. But it's the total number that's the most important piece. We're going to go now and talk about some of the findings, specifically risk reductions. We've just talked about the JCP interventions and what the juveniles look like. We're going to move over to the right-hand box here, talking about intermediate outcomes. Again, just to reiterate, the focus of these JCP-targeted interventions is to reduce crime. And by doing that, the way that we get to that point is by focusing on these targeted risk factors and making sure that we're trying to eliminate these indicators as much as possible. Also, it's important to mention that in and of themselves, the risk indicators are behavioral problems. So youth who have issues with school are also causing challenges for those school systems, for the communities. They may be dropping out. They may be using drugs. They may be having a lot of aggressive or disruptive behavior. So also by decreasing those problem behaviors, we're decreasing the impact that the kids are having on the community as a whole. The results, JCP youth had reduced risk for delinquency. We are seeing reductions in all 16 of the risk indicators that we measure over time. When we look at these indicators individually, we find that many of the youth who start out at time one having the presence of that indicator do not have it at time two, which is a very important finding. Youth had an average of 43% fewer risk indicators after JCP services. We measure the time two either when they're completed service or at 6 months if they're still participating at that point. So it's a 6 month follow-up or the completion of service. The biggest reductions that we're seeing were related to aggressive and destructive behaviors. Risk indicators in and of themselves had a variety of impacts. We saw changes from 15% to 88%, but certainly these large reductions were happening in the antisocial behavior area. The next table shows a summary of risk reductions by risk domains. So for the five required domains that are part of the JCP interventions, school failure, negative peers, antisocial behavior, poor family functioning, and substance abuse. And what you'll see here is a description of the proportion of youth who had that factor eliminated by time two. So when we look at indicators, for the first example with school failure, 60% of the youth who were experiencing school failure at time one no longer were at time two. Quite a dramatic impact. And just to clarify again, this is the domain level. These are out of those five domains. The next slide gives some example indicators for school failure as an example, what some of those specific risk indicators look like. And for this particular example, I'll start with the first one, academic failure. 58% of juveniles who were facing academic failure at time one were not at time two. 59% who were chronically truant at time one were not at time two. Each of the indicators impacts a different number of juveniles because some risk factors are more prevalent in this population than others. Okay, the next chart shows the proportion of youth whose total number of risk indicators increased, decreased, or stayed the same. We have a very large proportion of youth whose overall total numbers of risk indicators decreased over time, from time one to time two. We do have some youth, of course, where we don't see an absolute increase, and so we will be looking at those youth and trying to get more information about who those young people are. The next piece we want to talk about is the protective indicators. In addition to reducing risk factors, JCP programs also protect against delinquency by building the positive components of the youth's life. And these are the factors that help buffer the potential impact, the potential negative impact of those risk indicators. Again, we see very positive results after JCP. Interventions for those youth that are at high risk of delinquency, improvements ranging from 32% improvements to 79% improvements. In the next table, we provide a sample of the protective indicators, again, just to show you some specifics. For example, families are actively involved in helping the youth succeed in school. Out of the youth who did not have that positive factor, the protective indicator, at time one, 42% of them had gained it by the second time period. Finally, we want to take an opportunity to talk about the high-level outcomes. We're moving down now to the box, and we're going to talk specifically about reducing juvenile recidivism and some issues around these higher-level, longer-term outcomes. And Jeff is going to describe some of these preliminary findings for you.
Thanks, Dr. Mack.
Dr. Sprague, I'm going to let you guys go till like quarter till, because I know we have five people signed up, and that'll only give them about 3 minutes apiece. But I have some questions, so.
No problem. We'll speak as quickly as possible. I think we'll be done in about 5 minutes, and I think the graphs that are coming are will take care of themselves. Just a little bit of setup here. Regarding the results that you're about to see, and I'll explain, the three high-level outcomes, as you can see listed there, are listed in the statute. The first and third of the outcomes are reported through data from the OIA, and the middle outcome, which was our responsibility to measure via the evaluation. So these are, just a summary of JGIS data, and thanks to our colleague Barbara Selgin there in the back for helping us hunt this material down. And you can see fairly simply over the period from 98 to 2002 a reduction in that rate per thousand. So I think that's pretty straightforward. And I also want to note that as JGIS is fully implemented, we'll continue to get good, accurate data in that regard. If we go to the next slide, basically the percent of high-risk non-offenders with a first referral. So again, to remind the committee, part of the JC funds were targeted towards youth who are at high risk for offending but had not yet begun offending. And you can see that most of those kids did not offend, and basically the 4.7 of all youth in our state from age 10 to 7 commit some kind of a juvenile crime, so it's a kind of a nice comparator there in that regard.
Go back to the two slides. I'm going to ask some questions on.
Okay.
Go back one slide to the bar.
To the bar graph?
My question is, on the juvenile crime referral rate, that's kind of a straight line referral rate. Are there other factors that would be involved, whether it be population or other things? Or, I mean, is this a scientific way to look at this data to say, by the money we put in, we're reducing juvenile crime referral? I mean, I guess I don't know what the link is, and you guys haven't provided
we
the
have
link.
We have a little better, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Excuse me. We have, if you go ahead a couple of slides, we may be answering your question.
Okay. Oh, hold on.
Why don't we try that, if it doesn't work,
all right.
Okay.
I mean, I would have the same question on the referral within 12 months. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was before and what it is now. So
right. Right.
Okay.
Okay. So I think we can go past that slide. All right. So the long-range goal of JCP is to reduce future crime. Mr. Chair, I might also add, at this point, we're not fully through the cycle of our evaluation, so we should consider these results preliminary. They're good, but because of the way the timeline has been loaded, we really need to get out to June when our contract ends to sort of fully answer the questions. But again, glad to have the opportunity to share these today. So what you're going to see again is recidivism for JCP participants is lower than other juvenile offenders, again, statewide. The JCP program youth also had less serious and less frequent problems, those that did, than before their JCP intervention, and the recidivism rate appears to also be reduced for first-time offenders. So the next graph shows basically 79% of youth enrolled in JCP prevention services had a criminal offense in the 12-month period before their date of enrollment. Okay, so we want to start thinking about 12 months before enrollment and then 12 months after as essentially an artificial bin, which makes it useful to make this comparison. And then post-enrollment in the 12-month period after enrollment, 28% of those youth with a prior criminal referral had a new offense at some time during that period. Okay?
Sorry, George.
I was thinking about this the other day. Do you have any data that would indicate that there was a swing back up after that period of a 1 year, do you have any evidence of that at all?
Within the current data set we're working mm-hmm. with this evaluation, you've basically got almost up to date what the data are.
Right.
And
are we going to track that to see if they swing back, or will you track them to intervene if you do? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And again, at this point, we're partially dealing with an issue of window within the, you know, we have to see where we're at the end of the contract, and then basically. But yes, I think it's critical to understand and look, you know, as far out as possible regarding these youth, because once they're high risk, even with good supports like they're getting, they're going to remain high risk, and so we have to watch. Watch them. In the research, a good standard is that we often see is following kids for at least 18 months post-treatment. So, and we'd like to see it even longer than that. So to look at as they become adults, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Also, reoffending then, and you can cut me off if the time gets short, I'm almost done. Reoffending by youth with prior criminal referrals, basically the 42% rate is the rate for all youth offenders in the state during a 12-month tracking period, whereas youth who participated in JCP programs are coming in at about 28%, so a lower observed rate at this point in time.
Are the JCP youth generally self-selected, or are they referred?
They are. When the youth make a contact with the youth services department in their county, the risk assessment is administered as part of intake, and then the youth are selected on the basis of completing that risk assessment and then meeting the criteria for a sufficient number of risk factors on the screen. So if you're asking if they're volunteering, they're being selected. That's
okay. And are the all youth offenders a similar data set of types of crimes, severity of offenses versus the JCP youth offender? I mean, I'm just trying to get a handle on the data.
You've got, I'll make one comment and then also pass it to Juliet. Basically, the 42% is the whole youth in the JGIS data set. So, what, not to be make it more complicated than it needs to be, but because of the severity of the problems that these youth present, the more severe you get, the youth actually become more heterogeneous as opposed to homogeneous, meaning the risk factors are an amazing mix, and so it becomes very difficult to do that kind of matching, especially in this kind of context.
Mr. Chair, one difference that we did note between the youth offenders generally and the JCP was JCP youth tended to have higher numbers of risk factors than other youth. So it was more significant for us that we did see this type of reduction. I'm not certain that we have looked recently for this particular analysis at what the severity pace of their crimes was.
Okay, so I think for timing we can take more questions. Or
okay, I have one other question. I don't know. I'm not looking at my right often enough. Many would argue, Senator George would probably say, I'm not looking at my right often enough, too. But I have a question. You know, we're faced with a very, very difficult budget situation. These are substantial, you know, this is in comparison to some of the things we have, these grants are a substantial amount of money. My question to you, too, as kind of the researchers and people that we've had to continue the data collection is, as a committee, are we better off to, thin the soup as to the number of grants that are available, increase the number? We're just trying to figure out how we deliver the best program for the limited amount of dollars. Should we be focusing on those people who are higher risk factors and put those out to counties? Is there a different formula rather than just a straight up population that you've seen in the data that you've done? Those are always difficult questions.
So. Go ahead. But I think part of it, in at least implied in the presentation, if I understand your question properly, is again the risk factors outlined by the legislation are there. It's a robust set of five, and we might argue about a different set, but it's actually a pretty good set. And so, using a criteria of two or more. And I think in this case, both numerically and practically, say the difference between two or three, it's not an equal jump. So what we can say, I think, and I think any researcher in the country would tell you this, once a kid reaches or a youth reaches a threshold, then it becomes, at least with our current knowledge, very difficult to say, again, you should pick one flavor versus another. And in my own experience with both the Lane County DYS and other juvenile departments, I think that we see a lot of good decision making at the local level because they're the people that are facing the youth. So short answer is I think it's a pretty good formula.
So we should just continue to distribute on a population basis rather than target more specific types of programs that should get funded?
I think at this point,
I know it's a very difficult
question. No, it is a very difficult question.
That's what we're faced with. Well, when we're considering legislation policy committees that would say some of this has to be evidence based.
Yes.
The programs, and I know that all these are not all evidence based kinds of programs.
Mm-hmm. Fast answer: if we look at the research, we might be tempted, if you will, at this point because we've all got the language now, research based. Okay. We need to be aware that in the research that has been conducted so far, in a traditional treatment comparison group design, the interventions that have been tested, while some of them are multi-component, in other words, they do multiple things, many are not. And what we don't have, and really is the next challenge for researchers, is to look at the combination effects of how some of these interventions fit together. So at this point, it's basically an open question. And I wish I could answer the question more specifically, but I think in our conversations, both in our evaluation group as well as with other folk across the country, that's about where we're at with it. Okay?
Yeah, further questions for Dr. Sprague or Dr. Mackin? Oh, we certainly appreciate you being here. We apologize that we're short on time, but we certainly appreciate the data. And I, for one, feel that it's important if we're going to fund programs that we continue to fund the research that goes into tracking the data. It doesn't do us much good on the back end if we don't fund the whole continuum of making sure that it gets done. So thank you both, and I may call you later because I may have some more specific questions
for
the chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'd like to invite up David Fullerton and Joe Christie, as well as Larry Oglesby. Justin, are you coming up?
Yeah, I'm with Dave.
Okay, well then I'll just bring two of you up so
I can sneak out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Justin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I am the Intergovernmental Affairs Director with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. I am pleased to introduce to you today David Fullerton. David is the Social Services Director for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, and we would like to thank you in advance for this opportunity to speak today, and also to thank the members of the committee for their past support and continued support of the government-to-government process here in Oregon.
Thank you, Justin. Mr. Fullerton, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman, members, staff. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I believe that all the members and the chair have been provided a written document on the Confederated Tribes Grand Ronde's position regarding this bill, and at this time would respectfully request restoring funding to tribal prevention programs for the 2003-2005 biennium. I provided some national statistics and research regarding juvenile offenders and so forth, but I guess what I'd like to pay attention to and what we've heard the other speakers allude to is the five risk factors identified that lead to juvenile crime. And what's outstanding, what we can't ignore, is that the current statistics in Oregon show that American Indian, Alaska Natives lead in all five domains. We've heard the minimum qualifications for to qualify for the program funding under this is to meet two of those domains. Currently, our Native Americans, Alaska Natives are leading in all five domains. Some more statistics, 8% of Native Americans require substance abuse compared to 2% of all other racial and ethnic groups. Alcohol-related death rate for Native Americans, 39.4 per 1,000 compared to 6.7 for all other racial groups. So those are statistics that we can't ignore. And the even more outstanding and overwhelming is that the overpopulation, overrepresentation in the juvenile correctional facilities by Native American youth in Oregon compared to other racial and ethnic groups. And I think the emphasis for us, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, really advocating for these dollars is to prevent those numbers. And I think it's some of the good questions that were asked in the previous presentation are how and why to justify this money. And I think from our perspective is to put our money in the prevention, pay now or pay later, and I think that's really something that we need to look at. Some of the frustrations of this process is, to date still, Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde does not have juvenile crime prevention dollars from the state of Oregon. We've been promised $50,000 in the last biennium. We've cut to $25,000, and unfortunately that was cut creatively. Some of the staff have came up with a federal formula grant for the tribes to receive their $25,000. So we've heard the process that works from the researchers. We've heard the success stories. What we're asking is for a chance to participate in that. we're asking for the chance to provide prevention efforts from a community-based perspective for the Grand Ronde tribal members. And just to end here without going over all the statistics, we just ask that the committee continue to honor the spirit of Senate Bill 770, talk to the tribes, consider them, consult with them when making decisions regarding this funding, and allow us to participate in this process. Allow us to meet those one and two risk factors and to create programs for our kids.
Thank you, Mr. Fullerton. Questions? Thank you both for being here today. Thank you, Justin. So Joe Christie and Larry Oglesby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Christie. I'm director of Washington County Juvenile Department and immediate past president of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, which represents all 36 Oregon counties. I strongly support the continuation of these effective programs under the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership for the 2003-2005 biennium. I won't talk about the history or the philosophy behind the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership. You've already heard that. And I won't restate the evidence that what we're doing in juvenile crime prevention is working, because you've heard that as well. I just want to make a few concise and concrete points. First, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership is directly connected to the essential task of public safety in Oregon. These are strong programs that form a critical part of the whole juvenile justice system, resulting in reduced offending among youth. The way prevention is done here is not fuzzy and fluffy programs for kids. Instead, as you've already heard, our approach is targeted to identify the highest risk youth. And just as an aside to your question in terms of maybe focusing on the very highest risk youth, if you're talking about working with kids with four or five risk factors, that's also the most expensive kind of programming, and it's sometimes possible to serve a broader number of youth without a whole lot of additional cost, and because of the economy of scale, and still reach those that have been targeted in the high-risk population. And so in addition to that, we're using proven methods of stopping youth from serious crime, keeping them from victimizing others, and stopping the flow of into costly juvenile and adult correctional facilities that we pay a high price to operate. There's urgency in these services, and they're having an immediate impact now. Thousands of youth are being affected. Parents are involved, a factor that we know is a key to success. And much of the work, and here I can speak specifically about the services in Washington County, is being done in schools. Keeping youth in school is known to be the most critical risk factor in preventing juvenile crime. And though funding to nonprofit agencies in Washington County, we have highly trained staff in some elementary schools, in almost all of our middle schools and our alternative schools. And these staff that are in the schools, they identify problem kids early, work with teachers and counselors to keep the kids in school. They engage the parents in learning to better supervise and communicate with their youth, and teach kids the skills to be successful, all elements of what evidence has shown to be effective in preventing crime. We also sponsor after-school programs to keep youth engaged in productive and demanding activities during the period of time when most juvenile crime occurs. And we do specialized substance abuse intervention based on a drug court model. We emphasize cultural competency and reach many youth on the margins who are most likely to drop out, to commit serious crime, engage in violence, and make new victims. So this partnership with the schools is not a frill. It's an essential element of keeping youth in school and preventing criminal behavior. And the partnerships go beyond the schools to law enforcement, police departments, and to other organizations and citizens in the community. The rate of referrals to the Washington County Juvenile Department has declined by more than 30% since the programs began, in spite of a rapid population increase in the county. The Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership puts into practice what we know research and experience will be effective in reducing crime: to identify high-risk youth, to intervene early, keep them in school, involve their parents, teach them critical new skills. In passing Senate Bill 1 in 1995, this legislature mandated a full range of responses by juvenile justice to hold youth accountable and build responsible behavior. And juvenile crime prevention is integral to that historic investment, and it's already paying off. It's not about effects that will be realized far in the future. The effects are being felt now, and there are already reductions in both new crimes and in recidivism. Youth in juvenile crime prevention programs across the state commit fewer offenses, and their offenses are less serious and less frequent. And there have been immediate results in reducing other costly behavior that affects safety and quality of life: substance abuse, victimization, school suspension, and dropout. I'm awed by the responsibility that you have. I know that you have a lot of difficulties facing you in terms of the budget, and we know that there are further cuts coming and that they're essential. But we also know that we have built, in just the last few years, a single unified juvenile justice system with all the pieces in place, from earliest intervention with highest risk youth to incarceration. And we have to keep at least the skeletal structure in place so that we can continue that success. The result of fewer kids coming into the system and fewer repeat offenders will be lower costs for the court systems, for both juvenile and adult institutions, fewer victims of crime, and enhanced safety for all of us. We can't stop that now. Thanks for your time.
Mr. Christie, and I'm going to ask Mr. Ogilvie as well, and if Mr. Poppin can come up at the same time. We are really running short on time. I would like to ask the three of you as juvenile directors if you would get back to me as to, if these grants went away, what you think from your jurisdiction the impact upon OYA and other programs would be if we were to have to eliminate the programs. In addition, Mr. Christie, I'd like you to carry the message back to Washington County that if we were able to fund these grants, we're not getting much cooperation from the Washington County judicial system regarding what the sentencing guidelines and the paperwork is. Back to the Criminal Justice
Commission.
I have a
lot of influence.
And your grants. And those grants could be at risk should they continue to not participate your two colleagues on either side of you.
Mr. Chairman.
Might get some of your money as a result.
Mr. Chairman, since I'm the Washington County Senator here, remind them also that it's not just the judiciary, it's the district attorney in Washington County.
Yes.
Also.
So if you will carry that message home, we would certainly appreciate that. Not to put you on the spot or anything.
Yes. Don't mind truth the message.
Is there something we can bargain for here?
Go ahead, Larry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll be really brief. I know you're stretched for time. I just want to say a couple things. First of all, my involvement in this started at the close of session 1997, when the first work group was created to develop a strategy. So I have a lot of investment and a lot of passion for making sure that we do the best we can with this program and keep it going. Just briefly about our program in Marion County, we have what's called a family support program. It is a hybrid of two of the blueprint programs, functional family therapy and multisystemic therapy. And in regard to your question about evidence-based programs, our program has the evidence-based characteristics. It's not exact replica, and it allows us to serve more kids that way. We're still having many of the benefits of the blueprint programs. Our program serves an entire family, sometimes up to three generations. The kid who is referred to the program, any siblings or any adults in that family who have situations that are impacting on that kid's ability to be successful and crime-free, we're providing service to those kids. We focus on the high-risk youth. Almost all of them are not in the court system officially. They are 12 and under with at least three of the five risk factors. We started with three right from the very beginning based on some research that we were aware of, that that was sort of the point at which the likelihood became even greater of future criminality. We involve a team approach, which include our family support specialists, who are in essence the case managers, who work closely with schools, treatment providers, the parents and the youth. The concept is we're there to help the family deal with their issues. We're not there to do it for them, but to work them so that when they are out of the program, they can carry on successfully. We also include with that some individualized service plan funds, which sometimes is the difference between success and failure with many of these families. Things as basic as prescriptions, an eye exam for a girl who's having trouble in school, emergency assistance to keep the family from being evicted, drug treatment for a dad who is a primary caregiver for his two sons. Those are just some examples of the way we're able to use some of those funds to do those things on the margin that will help these kids and families be successful. So we believe this has been very successful in our county, and would urge the committee to think seriously about keeping this going. And I know you have tough choices. We have a structure in place, and even though the structure or the overall scope may be reduced, we want to maintain that structure if at all possible.
Thank you, Mr. Oglesby.
Yeah. Quick question. On your service delivery, are you directly providing these services or paying for them, or are you seeing based on the other service cuts that the state's having to do, is it harder for you to get this package of services to your families?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, currently we are providing this at a reduced level based on the fifth special session reductions. We are still able to have a viable program at this point in time. There will be a point at which, if reductions go, which will be much more difficult. If the program is not there, if that's the other part of your question.
No, I'm not asking about your program as much as, are you seeing other decreases in Marion County's mental health programs or drug and alcohol treatment programs and stuff that are making it harder to serve these families?
Yes, both of those, alcohol and drug and mental health, there will be reductions there. The Youth Authority budget is being impacted significantly, and we've been really hammered there in terms of access to state training school beds, residential treatment, shelter care, a whole range of services that we rely on that are funded by the state.
Further questions?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Doug Poppin, and I'm the director of the Clackamas County Juvenile Department. I did have written testimony that I won't actually go over. So maybe I'll just highlight a couple of things just to try to protect some of the time. First, the juvenile crime prevention plan dollars are used in our county to fund a variety of programs, and I'll cite just some of those, but they really do consist of research-based practices, such things as family functional therapy, such things as cognitive behavioral group skills for kids. Those are all programs that are actually proven to work. Since the juvenile crime prevention program started in our county, we have gone from an arrest rate of 40 kids per 1,000 down to 23. That is a tremendous, tremendous significant improvement in our county with juvenile arrest rates. The programs that we fund with these juvenile crime prevention monies are juvenile firesetter prevention programs. I mentioned the behavioral cognitive skill development groups, family functional therapy, crisis respite care, a Clackamas County mental health therapist located at the juvenile department to provide assessments and service for those kids that have mental health problems, community accountability diversion panels in city jurisdictions, and school dropout prevention programs. As you can see, these programs really do target a very serious high-risk youth. On the back of my paper that I submitted to you, you'll see just two examples that I drew that kind of highlight some of the kind of kids that we work with and some of the services that are provided them and the outcomes. And I won't read that. You can look at that when you get time. In summary, I have many more examples of cases like that where programs funded by the JCP are having positive and significant impact on the lives of the kids and their families. Please know that these programs do work, and I know you're interested in funding programs that work. I encourage you to keep these funded. I know what a difficult time the state is having with its budget, and you have some very difficult decisions to make. But these programs work, and they are proven to be cost-effective. So I appreciate your time and your consideration for the juvenile crime prevention programs.
Thank you, Mr. Pappas. Any questions for the panel? Thank you all, and I look forward to getting a letter back from you on if these had to go, if these went away, what kind of effect we would see and impacts on the OAA system as well as others. Thank you, gentlemen. I have two people from Benton County who are here. Joanne Miller, who is the director of the Benton County Commission on Children and Families, as well as Judy Edwards from Lynn and Benton Counties from the ESD. I don't know if you have coordinated testimony. Or it's just nice to see faces from Benton County.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joanne Miller. I'm the director of the Commission on Children and Families in Benton County. And I won't take a lot of time because I realize that we're running short and you're really pressed. But I wanted to talk a bit about the relationship between the juvenile crime prevention efforts and the local Commission on Children and Families. In Benton County and in several other counties throughout Oregon, the juvenile crime prevention strategy is part of the Commission on Children and Families' overarching comprehensive plan. One of our targets within the commission system, as well as for the state of Oregon, is to develop a system of services and support that streamline those highest risk services for those highest risk kids at the local level and coordinate them with all the service systems that are available to communities throughout the state. In Benton County, we have used our juvenile crime prevention funds and work closely with our juvenile justice officials and a director to develop a system of support that blend these resources of commission dollars, federal grant dollars that we have applied for and used those dollars as leverage, and local generated funds to prevent juvenile crime. As a result, if you ask the question, what would happen if those dollars went away, we would see a significant impact and loss of services for our community. We have identified a need of a shelter care. It was not one available for homeless and runaway youth. Within the juvenile crime prevention system, we were able to help develop that shelter care with the partnerships. We are serving between 100 and 150 youth per quarter for 1 to 3 night stays and reuniting those families with those dollars. They're receiving A&D treatment. They're getting school efforts so that they're maintaining school and not dropping out. Child abuse rates are way down. A lot of those kids are victims of child abuse and have fled the home as a result. So with those dollars, they have a great impact on our community. The ability to blend those dollars and look at that continuum is important. As we lose these types of services, and as you identified already, the losses with other budgetary cuts, these kind of prevention efforts would no longer be available. So we hope that you would consider the impact that it would have in Benton County, and I'm sure in all other 35 counties throughout Oregon, and try and keep as much of this intact for the fidelity of our communities.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, a lot of what I was going to say has already been said, so I'm just going to talk
for the
about
record,
a few
you're...
new things. Oh, I'm Judy Edwards, I manage the juvenile crime prevention program, the entire program in Lynn County, and one of the projects in Benton County. We've had the same projects going on for over 5 years and have seen significant changes in risk factors and protective factors. I have a handout I'll give you which shows our specific results. One of the things that Joanne mentioned briefly that I want to talk about is the blended funding that we have used. Our project has been able to expand countywide and more than double the JCP funding that we get available through blending of commission funds, and we match with administrative Medicaid funds so that we more than double our capacity to serve these at-risk youth. In addition, our JCP project staff in 1 year and every year receive an additional $100,000 at least donated goods and services from communities to support these youth and families. Our projects are so similar to Larry Oglesby's that I'm not even going to talk specifically about them, including the name of the project. There's a couple of things. The Lynn County Commission, and we are the JCP project for that body, based on several years of experience, we have been the number one priority for their funding for all 5 years, and that's made up of a lot of citizens that continuously say we are making a difference and have the resources go there. In Lynn and Benton counties both, we have been for the last several months meeting on a monthly basis with all the agency directors, all the school superintendents, as well as local commissioners, to try and lessen the impact of the budget cuts that are happening in mental health and in drug and alcohol and all those other things. Almost consistently every month, our juvenile department director, Stephen Dye, says every time his program services are being dismantled somewhat by the cuts, and if anything, we need to keep the family support JCP project whole to prevent those kids from getting into a system that is crumbling. So I want to thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Edwards. Any questions for the lady from Benton County? Thank you both for coming. We apologize. We're on such a tight schedule again. Your cleanup hitter today is Mr. Wasson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee and staff, I'm Billy Wasson. I live here in Salem. And Phil told me if I took more than 2 minutes, I was wasting my time. So, with that, I spent 34 years working in the adult system before I retired and went into our wonderful PERS system. And when I did that, I looked around and said, well, I should give back and I should get engaged, and decided that I would commit my time to the other end of the system, a children and youth system, and have sought out, and as you can tell from my testimony, which you have there in front of you, agreed to serve on the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, which I currently chair, and I'm also a member of the JCPAC, which is the subject today. I didn't stop working, however. I operate as a national consultant, working mostly for the National Institute of Corrections, going to states, looking at adult systems, mostly crowded systems that are looking for advice and assistance on how do they manage that crowding. In the process of doing that, of course, I've gotten introduced and trained and exposed to evidence-based practices. I really have gotten pretty passionate about that, even though it is late in my career, and wanted to bring something to the table here which may be unique to your testimony that you haven't heard, at least in the other testimony. In 25 states I've been to since retiring, frankly, I've not found another state that has the infrastructure in place to track outcomes, much less even have the leadership to commit to them. Oregon is unique in that regard. That infrastructure includes such things in this state as a juvenile justice information system, which is statewide, well-developed, and well-operated. Frankly, I don't know whether you know this, but other states don't have that infrastructure. Even if they wanted to commit to outcomes and evidence-based practice, they couldn't track and know whether or not they were achieving or doing anything. So what a pleasure it is, and how proud I am to be from Oregon. I'm here to suggest to you, and you'll see my little paper there is attached if you have an opportunity to look at that, or if you want to send me questions, I'm sure my email address is in there. I want, of course, that you continue your commitment to the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program. The evidence is there that what we're doing is the right direction. We're making impacts on long-term outcomes, which is the bottom line. And a legislative body like yourself, I think your primary policy responsibility, my opinion as one of your citizens, is to focus on outcome. So we are finally there. We have the infrastructure in place. We're able to track outcomes. The evidence shows that we are, in fact, making a difference. When else have you had an opportunity to fund programs that have an evidenced, documented ability to make an impact? I encourage your support with this program. Stand your questions.
Mr. Wasson, you obviously, being on the JCPAC, review a lot of what goes through on the grant stuff.
Oh, sure.
My question to you is, as someone who reviews that grant information, have you seen a trending you spoke very passionately about evidence-based programming.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the majority of the money is getting out to those evidence-based programs? Do we still have a ways to go? Is there some things that we can do to improve? I mean, now it goes out by population, so there's really not a whole lot. There's a lot of flexibility in what can be done.
Well, when I was employed by Marion County, I would be here telling you we need to put it out by county. I no longer have those needs to tell you that. I got to stay true to evidence-based practices and the five risk factors and the documented national research around those. The trend I see is us raising the bar in terms of cutoff scores from two risk factors to three risk factors. My prediction is, with the money continuing to shrink, we will raise the bar to perhaps four risk factors, and we'll focus it in that regard. When will we come to the point where we look at the spread by counties or perhaps by tribes and decide that there are higher-risk kids in certain geographic areas of the state and therefore we move the money there? I'm not sure. I probably, given the choice with the shrinkage, I would have to stick with the evidence and focus the money around where the highest risk is and answer your question.
Thank you, Mr. Wasson.
Questions for Mr. Wasson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. Just briefly, is Oregon's juvenile justice information system really that unique nationwide, and what makes it so unique?
First short answer, yes, it is unique. Not only that, but the adult information system, which is also statewide, which preceded the juvenile information system, is also unique. What makes it unique? That you could have these separate jurisdictions of counties and the state actually collaborate to agree where they could agree on, A, what are the data elements they want to collect, and two, they're going to let each other see each other's data, and three, they're going to do it in a unified, consistent way. That's what's really unique. Believe me, having worked and had the scars from the adult system where we put that system in place over a long career, it's a long history, as it is with juvenile. And you, whatever you do, encourage that infrastructure and don't damage those successes, because without that infrastructure, trying to go evidence-based or tracking outcomes, you can't do it. All you'll get is people like me coming in here, working in programs, not wanting you to cut my program, giving you a prayer and a promise that we're doing good things. And I've been here that over the years doing many of those kind of testimonies. So.
Yeah. Representative Hansen.
Thank you. For the various people in the office supporting this, what the information that I probably need is, as we see the other cuts in government services, which are the ones that are vital to keeping the success of these programs going? I mean, if we lose A&D funding, is it OYA beds? What are the other programs that help contribute to the successes that we're seeing? I don't need, you know, specific inventory now, but that would sure be helpful as we proceed on into the budgeting process.
Can I give you a short answer?
Yeah.
You have the ceremonial and unthankless task of trying to figure out what is the appropriate balance between custody and treatment, whether it be adult or juvenile, and that's the process you're in. I just encourage you to not teeter the balance too far and decide that you only need to fund custody, and you can walk away from the other end of the teeter-totter, which is these interventions and treatment. You need a balance. That's my advice. That's what the national research shows as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wasson. Mm-hmm. All right. With that, we didn't have anyone else signed up, and we are out of time. So at this point in time, Phil, did you have any final cleanup?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, in response to Senator George's earlier question about the 12-month limit on recidivism tracking, most recidivism, both adult and juvenile, occurs within 12 months. And so where we can do longer term that would give us more information, but in terms of finding out most of the recidivism on most of the people, that's where we focus, and that's where we've done. I want to just thank everybody here who's come and testified, and thank in advance all my colleagues out in the hall who are clamoring to come in and support my budget as well.
So. Thank you, Phil. At this point in time, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5012. If people want to stay, you're more than welcome to stay, but I know that there's a bunch of people out in the hallway who want to get in here too, so I won't be offended if you leave.
give us some time to set up for a second.
Bright lights, big city. You know what I think? If somebody comes to testify, I may have to sit there. Is that better?
Oh, sit over there. Oh, yeah.
Huh?
Well, you sit there. Good.
Well, if we get a block there, so if we don't move them back.
No, but I mean, if we have somebody that we're going to work through this, and then. But if we have questions, we can bring people.
They can sit on the floor in front of the office. You're always in the front of the office. You're my kind of. You just got to make it.
Okay.
You make it work.
Did we hand out sticks?
Yep.
All right, we're going to roll. So I'll let the masses crowding out in the hallway come in.
I'm not a war party, I've been
here.
That's why they use small rooms.
Under the light of day.
Yeah.
No, I'm focused under the light of day so we can see what's going on. Bright lights, big city. All right. A different and interesting concept based upon what's been done in this committee before. We've been asked we've been asked by the co-chairs of Ways and Means to provide a priority list from this committee. The group of budgets that are represented in this committee, as we're all aware, may certainly have a stronger interrelationship than most other committees' budgets in and of themselves. We've been trying to look at the public safety system as a whole system. I took the first cut, and we'll take all credit and arrows and darts and bullets and whatever else the case may be on the draft of the working priority list for the public safety subcommittee. For the audience members who are here today to watch and observe, we've asked several people to be here in case we have technical questions or other issues, but we're going to let the committee work through this to some degree, then we're going to bring it back again probably on Monday, potentially. So we'll make that decision. There is a version 6 of the public safety priority working list. I have made some changes on my list. Those changes appear in bold and italic as a result of some conversations and some data and information I've learned. It's a very difficult and arduous task as to this in terms of how we put together a public safety system within each of the various line items of the 119 line items we now have. There's definitely a degree of scope that we can go within each of those categories. We're still going to maintain and look for efficiencies, but I think the goal here is to get some input from the rest of the committee as to if things need to be changed, if we've overlooked some things, and what potentially some of the issues that we've all helped identify. Unfortunately, the OYA budget and the corrections budget we've not yet heard, but we've been asked to produce something for the co-chairs, as everyone well knows. So I'd just like to open it up for the various committee members and talk about how I tried to put this thing together to put some of those constitutional items as items number one in terms of constitutional items. The degree, obviously, especially in corrections and all those things, have, depending on how many people we have incarcerated, the numbers are going to change to some degree or another. But the issue, those are the issues surrounding corrections. And the chair, as is my bias, I guess, in this case, put the courts at the top. I feel that we have a balanced justice system that needs to be heard at all levels, and I think that that's a fundamental element of our democracy, and it's my intent to fully fund the court, as I've told the members of this committee.
Mr. Chair, in your examination of the constitutional requirements that we may have relative to public safety, did you find anything perhaps that may be less onerous than some of the other constitutional requirements, hitching posts for horse or anything, and that's still included in there?
The hitching posts for horses and things like that. I'm sure that there's some degree of constitutionality, and especially those items which are both federally and mandated by the state constitution, but I've not tried to put those in any particular order. The list as it sits now is sorted 1 to 10, and within each category it's sorted by department.
So if it's constitutional, it's on the list under constitutional requirements. Whether or not it has a high, super high priority, you haven't attempted to try.
Well, and I have moved some of the constitutional issues around that we potentially could do, or statutory items. For example, to me, it didn't make a lot of sense if we were to prioritize a funding list. If we were going to change misdemeanors to violations, all except domestic violence and DUII, that we didn't have to then provide indigent defense for those, because there would be no prison sentence that would be involved in funding those. So I moved some of those things around because the constitutional requirement would go away. I tried to cost the indigent defense costs in terms of where I put. I tried to rank in corrections the kind of the bad, you know, the worst types of felons all the way down to the misdemeanors. And so that's what I tried to redo. I know some people had notes and other things on this list, or if anyone else wants to. So what I'd like to do is either let the committee members comment maybe individually and have some discussion, or we can go through number-wise. What's the committee's pleasure?
Mr. Senator Chairman, Devlin. On the old list, there was 109. On this one, there are 119.
Right.
I went through the old one. I would say, you know, I can characterize my comments without actually going through them one by one. Or if the chair wanted, I'd be willing, I don't know how many members of the committee would be, to assume this is a Microsoft program.
It's up here, and we can dynamically change it. That's why we put it this way.
So, I mean, I'd be willing to give the chair my own list with the changes. But I generally, the only areas that I was probably significantly different were a couple, and that's I generally ranked all of forensics a little bit higher, although the chair split up different aspects of forensics. I generally ranked criminal investigation for OSP, regardless of the nature of the investigation, as somewhat higher. I ranked some of the indigent defense a little bit higher, depending upon what the crime was. And then there were a couple of items that just actually fell out of the ranking, in the sense of I didn't really feel like ranking them as such. I just felt we had a moral obligation to do them. And one of them was the memorial fund, funding it adequately. I don't really, if I had to rank it, I'd put it as a one, but I just felt we had a moral obligation since we had made the commitment to fund it adequately. Now, that might not mean that we have all the funds available for it that you'd want in the long term, but just at least to adequately fund our needs in this biennium. And the second one is kind of different by comparison. It's simply the scholarship fund, the few remaining funds with the National Guard there. I just wanted to make sure with the little funds that were left there that we at least kept the commitments to people, and we examined what our actual commitments were to people almost on a case-by-case basis. So if we had made a commitment and we couldn't fulfill it, that under these sorts of guidelines, that we at least kept those commitments. But those are the... That would probably explain about 90% of my changes to the chair's list.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Well, very, very similar to your view on the constitutional issues. I've ranked all of those as number one. And I think that kind of gets down to the oath of office that we took. And certainly there can be discussion in terms of how many dollars we put forth for each constitutionally mandated service and how much is adequate. I kind of cheated and made all statutory requirements a two.
which, of course, could change dramatically if we start changing statutes, but at this point in time, we haven't, and I'm not. There were some similar issues with, I ranked a lot, gave some higher rankings as threes to things that I felt were vital to other agency coordination, like the forensics unit, which I think I also gave a two because it's statutorily required too. I gave some fours to some groups where the dollar amount, maybe in terms of a public safety priority, wasn't real high. But for example, the military, the amount of federal funding that we get in matching dollars is significant. The tobacco task force, again, it's much more based as a revenue function of revenue than public safety, but I think in this kind of a budget environment, that's important. And then the rest of the things I rated from five through ten, more on the basis of how important I feel that activity is.
I think that
well, thank you so much.
If you didn't like what I was saying,
I was agreeing with you.
It's only thing that Christine's over there in the corner.
Your ears all right?
Anyway, Mr. Chair, probably similar to what Senator Devlin said in terms of being able to turn these in and get some kind of compilation at some point. It might work.
Gary or Tom?
Mr. Chair, my approach has probably been more along the line of your approach, and that is the direction that has been given to us by the co-chairs to direct resources towards health, human services, public safety, and education, that which has grandma on the ice floe or pretty close to the ice floe. My concern is, relative to all of the public safety issues, that they be funded appropriately and in proportion to the degree that they would provide for the public safety of grandma who might be on the ice floe and for the educational concerns that we have. I think one of the comments that stands out in my mind from the testimony which we have heard in the public safety sub has been that if the youngsters are at school but they're not safe coming and going or at school, then what good is full funding towards education? So I am concerned about the priorities that we've been given within the ways and means process. I think that's much the approach you've taken, Mr. Chair.
Senator, anything?
Well, I'm a little bit bothered. I look down through the ranking, and if I had my druthers, it wouldn't be in any kind of order like that. But it's a good order, except I do get down to one that bothers me, and also as was expressed by Senator Devlin, and that is the memorial fund. You know, just primarily because it's a little bit of money, and it's kind of like I've yet to. But that's other than that, I'm agreeing that that's probably a proper order.
What I'd like to do is, if people don't mind, I'd like to go through any specifics that people have. I'm willing to move the Public Safety Memorial Fund. You know, I want to get a sense of the committee and get committee buy-in. It's going to be a tough session for all of us. And if we want to move that up as a committee, I mean, we're not bound by this list by any way, shape, or form to do that. And I realize that program's not a lot of money. And if we want to put it as a one, a two, whatever, I'm happy to move that. So, what's the...
Mr. Chairman, I'll move it in as a two, right under constitutional.
Okay. Is everyone else okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. What I'd like to do is go up through the 10. I don't imagine much is going to move down, or anyone's going to move down. So, I'd like to move up through what we've got, and identify some of those issues that people would like to see changed around, so at least we give the co-chairs a reasonable amount of guidance as to what this is. So I know Senator Devlin and Representative Hansen
Has anyone got any other things in 10 that we need to put in there, or any other issues that we should consider? I mean, we're going to consider scoping in all of these. Anything? Anyone got anything in 10? No.
Well,
Senator Hansen. Representative Hansen.
I had dispute resolution listed as a 7 with the note, and in a lot of these, it's based on different circumstances, can move things, I would think, a great deal. But dispute resolution listed as 7 with reductions. But
okay.
And then youth challenge that I would hope there was some way that we could keep that going with some type of restructuring. I think it's a strong program.
I'm trying to figure out what we should. How we're going to highlight these, Doug, to go back and look at.
I'm making notes here, so I may not need to do it.
Okay, so dispute resolution. We bolded some of these other ones. So. Isn't there like a? I thought there was a highlighter marker.
You can underline them.
All right. Senator Devlin, anything on the fence?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And I've got these. Trying to track my own handwriting.
Right. Council, I have the same problem.
Council on court procedures, I rank significantly higher, primarily because it's a very limited amount of money, and yet I think it smooths out procedures. And I think our testimony from them indicated there were some ways to keep the program going at less dollars.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Devlin.
I would like to move the scholarship program to an 8, in recognition that it's not actually, I think there's like $50,000 left in the fund. I'm not actually even talking about the full $50,000. I just want to get a clear explanation about commitments and what portion might be still necessary to keep commitments that have already been made. If that's $10,000, I'm fine with that. If it's $15,000, I'm fine with that, and the rest can go into whatever pot. Because there is an understanding that we don't have the funds to continue the program. So,
I think I spelled it right. Get it right? Okay.
My wife says that. Representative Patrick, my wife says that men can't spell the word commitment.
Or don't want to.
I've never.
I won't go there. Right?
We even had problems spelling entertainment.
All right. In the 9s. Issues in the 9s.
Mr. Chair, I had State Fire Marshal rated considerably higher, a 4 again, based on its relationship with other agencies and based on solving their financial problems with non-general fund dollars. I think they're legislation pending on different forms of funding for the state fire marshal.
All right.
Will the pending funding, Mr. Chair, accommodate the full needs of the state fire marshal? The discussions.
Mr. Chair, it would be at what level, and there's a proposal out there, and it's a matter of what level you would set an assessment at. Right now, the state fire marshal does not receive any general fund.
I realize that. Yeah, but the concern that I have is that without some serious changes into the assessment and the way that we structure the credits for those folks that pay those assessments, we're headed for a major wreck there.
Senator George.
Doug, help me with that. State Fire Marshal is no general fund. What's he doing here?
There are certain items on here that made it on the list from the author of the list, I'm sorry.
Yes.
There are some CFA-funded issues also on this list that, of course, does have a general fund relation because of the way it's divided. And I think the fire marshal put on because it was probably, there was a funding issue there, too. So if we do have to backfill with federal fund or general fund to keep it going, it may have to be on the list.
Mm.
Okay. It is a primary public safety issue that has a funding issue right now.
Senator Devlin?
Chairman, in addition to the state fire marshal, I have the consumer protection financial fraud only moved up simply a single step up to 8. And the reason is because some cases may be not merit higher, but we occasionally do get into some very serious cases in terms of fraud with seniors, in terms of bilking them out of large portions of their assets. And even those are those sometimes are not prosecuted the same way as other crimes. I think they have a fairly major impact on people.
I think my intent at putting it at a 9 was just, I think we've also asked the Attorney General, and I think they have provided that, though I haven't had time to go through it, to look at a fund shift as to their trust fund. So we could temporarily do that. And I think I saw the Attorney General, I think, out in the hall. Are you here on behalf of the Attorney General?
I am.
Okay. And I think that the Attorney General's provided us a fund shift. So I'm going to put shift in there, and then Doug will go back. I'll go back and look at that.
Mr. Chair, that program it gets a little over $2 million, I believe, in general fund in the budget, and the rest of it is other funds from a variety of sources. So there is other funds for this program generally.
All right. Anything else in the nines?
Mr. Chair, I've got a lot of them where I differ with your ranks by one point one way or the other, and I don't know how relevant we need to go in. It's probably just a judgment call on relative importance.
Well, if you've got
I see something that jumps
significantly, yeah. But otherwise, why don't you give me your other list so I can look at that, and then I'll try and build a consensus kind of list.
Are we going up the list, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Are we the sevens yet?
No, we are in the eights. Anyone have anything in the eights? Just so the committee knows, I tried to put, what I did was, is I put the adult non-person misdemeanors and adult felon PCS cases down in here in the eights for indigent defense. Under the wild illusion that if we had to go there's some cost savings that would occur if we made them violations instead of, which I think believe they're doing in Multnomah County now and in Lane County already. They have the option by statute to do that, but I don't think that we could accrue any cost savings to those unless we mandated it as a state, because district attorneys in their own districts have charging decisions to make those, and those drive our indigent defense budgets. And unless we were willing to step up as a legislature, I think it is unlikely that we could move those. We could have a cost savings. Senator George.
This is for Doug. Doug, help me with number 93, Fish and Wildlife. I understand that's a transfer in.
There, Mr. Chair, Senator George, there is, I'm going to say, $3 million, I'm working off the top of my head, of general fund in Fish and Wildlife. Right. Danny, is that about right? Four, thank you.
Four.
And then there's a significant amount of transfer in from Fish and Wildlife that, you know, to a certain extent, mm-hmm. independent of this list.
My understanding, though, in the Fish and Wildlife, Danny, correct me if I'm wrong, is that most of that money is for overtime money because we're using these officers for overlapping function. Is that correct? Is that you can come up if you want.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Danny Bisgard, State Police Budget Director. The $4 million is basically the general fund portion of that budget, as the Chair has talked about. There are items and enforcement issues that they do that are not funded. It could be a drunk driver or accident, whatever the case may be. But it also funds the management structure, supervision. The majority of those positions are funding those. There's a little over $14 million other fund transfers in that come in, and a little over $5 million Measure 66 lottery money that comes in as well for that enforcement.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one item that was cut out of the budget in the cuts this binding was commercial fisheries, too, which may have some interest to you.
Mm-hmm.
That was a general funded only part of Fish and Wildlife.
I have had a couple of people approach me on some of the positions on the list, and some of them believe if they're down at these low numbers and they're going to be cut, they think the whole program's gone. And that's why I was asking that question. All we're talking about is that portion that would be coming from the general fund in this list.
And it's not necessarily that we're going to cut all the way up. Yeah. I mean, as I said, they're scoping within each of these programs. But, but based upon the no judgment budget that's out there and other items, we have to. That's why we're ranking. We're trying to get the programs together to help set the public policy.
Mr. Chair, to the extent that you're taking input relative to swapping the numbers around, I still continue to be concerned that that the tendency appears to be to move these items further and further and further back up the list. The concern I've got is that we were instructed that these were for some suspensions of programs potentially in order to save the general funds for those mandatory items, and the backfills will be necessary for us to comply with our constitutional mandate. So I am concerned that as we try and force more items back up towards the top of the list, that this isn't to eliminate certain programs as much as it is to go ahead and suspend those programs which do not address the immediate public health issue, a public safety issue of the folks that we're called to serve.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And just to address our Senator Devlin's issue on the Oregon State Police section there on the criminal and drugs, I felt if we were taking away if we were going to decriminalize most of those drugs, that it didn't make a lot of sense at that point in time.
Somebody's not planning to vote for it.
Well, which I doubt there are the votes, which the chair doubts are there are the votes in the bill to pass. But as you can see, if we had to cut from the bottom up, like was envisioned, I think, by a lot of people on the health plan, we're really not at a lot of savings at this kind of level. So,
although, Mr. Chair, that strategy might play into the tourist development.
Okay. Any other things on item number 8 that we would like to highlight, that the rest of the committee would like to highlight so we can take a look at? All right. Sevens.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
The first seven.
DUII.
Indigent defense. If I could be assured that we have the general funds to provide defense counsel to DUII so they could be tried, I'd be okay at 7, but I'd be more comfortable at 6, because even when you talk about health and welfare, I put that pretty high up on the list in terms of comparing it to other criminal activity, criminal arm. So if we end up with a cutoff, that means we're not, you know, we're going to start to plead down DUII so that they don't need counsel, then I'd push them up higher than a 7.
Well, and I think that the issue is, to me, 7 is where you start to hit substantial cost savings. If you have to go to $180 to $200 million, which is what it looks like, in a no-judgment budget or under the governor's scenario, that we'll have to get to. And until you get to the 7s, you really don't have a substantial amount of cost savings until you get into the 7s. And the 7s are where everyone starts falling off. And I struggled with this, too, because I put defense counsel for DUIIs in here. There's also the delinquency, which is the misdemeanor juvenile, because I thought we put the juveniles up higher, but we have the adult person misdemeanor, which is the domestic violence cases, yeah, and cases like that. So those are the cases that we have as we approach 7, as well as the Oregon State Police Patrol Division, which is $75 million, the OIA patrol, or the parole and probation officers, and actually it's not parole and probation for OA. We need to, if you'll mark that, Doug, so we can change that particular piece. And corrections, I put, those were the 1145 people. I put at this similar level, too. Those are the people who are less than a year in jail. Those are some of the higher degree theft cases and some of those kinds of things. They're all in this level.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll trust in your judgment, but I will reserve that when we actually get to the budget, if it comes out that DUIs are not going to get prosecuted, I may try to push them up farther on the list.
Mr. Chair. Representative
Butler.
I was interested in some discussions that we had had with Director Weeks relative to some of the OIA facilities, the possibility of putting in to the empty OIA facilities some of the very low-level adult criminals. And if since that time, I've had an opportunity to just visit briefly with Ben DeHaan, the interim director from the Department of Corrections. The concern that I've got, and Mr. DeHaan indicates that we're going to be several hundred above the current list, at least 200 above the current list that will be in the prison system. And so let me just ask this question while we're at that point with regard to the 1145. Should some of those low-level, non-person-to-person offenders be considered for release under the, I say release, for detention and local control under Senate Bill 1145, amplifying the scope of 1145 to some of the non-person-to-person, the very low-level criminals, but with a local touch to them so that they can come back home into the communities. Not necessarily released, but still under the local jurisdiction.
So let me be clear. I'm not quite clear what you're asking. I think you're asking that could we put 1145 offenders at an OIA facility?
Basically, could you put the nonviolent offenders into the 1145 and fill back up the full 1145 measure, the obligation which we've got to the counties?
Under 1145, it was all those felons that were under a year based upon the sentencing guidelines.
I realize that. So what you may have is you may have some 10-year folks in there that are non-violent offenders, the guys that kept their books out for 3 weeks from the local library too long that got 20-year sentences.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think we have any of those, but...
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. But
well, we should.
We probably should. Do you think we'd have to pay a library assessment, too, in the state budget?
Mr. Chair, on the Youth Authority Basic Services grants, I had those listed as a 5 instead of a 7. The crime prevention, juvenile crime prevention grants, I had listed as a 5.
I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about prevention versus incarceration and what the committees, you know, that's what we're going to be faced with to some degree in this budget, Esther. Where the incarceration, but first I want to get back to Representative Butler's issue. I think that we've had Department of Corrections has already run some numbers on using the facilities and some of the OIA abandoned facilities to see about using those, and I think you've seen copies of that.
Yep.
I think we will share those with the rest of the committee as we move forward with the corrections budget, and I think that that's something we need to very seriously consider instead of potentially paying for out-of-state beds.
Well, and my concern is that on the those beds which are dedicated for 1145 in the counties, to the extent that those aren't full, that's still a cheaper way for the state to go ahead and pay for those. And I recognize that the crimes that we're talking about are now folks that are detained over the 12 months. But to the extent that we're not talking about violent offenders, we may have some better buy-in with our local partners, the counties.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about it. I would like to talk a little bit about the prevention issues and versus the incarceration issues. I mean, it's a very, very, very difficult. It's going to be a very, very difficult issue. Representative Hansen.
Well, I guess I'm really struggling with that too because it's so hard to look at any of these issues in a vacuum. And when we're talking about the other cuts in programs, I'm real concerned how those cuts could affect these programs. But I guess my bottom line is it's cheaper to prevent. It's better to spend the money on the front end and keep somebody out of our institutions that way than pay for it at the back end.
The other one is if we end up shorting, and I'm afraid if we're looking at a revenue-based set of budgets, if we end up, we're only going to be able to really do half measures in a lot of things. So, I mean, the problem is if we close 200 OYA beds and then don't have, and then salvage some prevention dollars to try and, or cut the prevention dollars to try and save some of those beds, we just fill them up immediately, and we haven't really made any progress. We've actually fallen back that we'll have less beds available for the kids that would need the beds than if we stuck with the prevention dollars.
Are you more concerned about that in the juvenile area as opposed to the adult prevention stuff, or both?
Well, I think
my issue is that we're probably going to have a static amount of crime that's going to occur, that's going to some degree overwhelm the system, and so I'm trying to figure out how you strike the balance as to what's reasonable and what's not.
Well, I think I'm much more concerned in terms of the juvenile programs.
Okay.
From the standpoint that if you can, the chances of if you can prevent juvenile crime, probably in the long run you're going to be preventing some adult crime too. And then I think because of the system we've got in place, we can better identify the benefits that we're getting from the juvenile prevention programs. Probably the same dynamic occurs to both. It's just that I think it's a lot more demonstrable on the juvenile side.
Okay. Senator Devlin.
This is, Mr. Chairman, this is a question for Representative Hansen. I heard that
you yield, Representative Hansen.
I can't spell entertainment either.
Commitment?
It depends.
I'm moving.
You were going to move two that were listed as eights as fours, right?
No, eights to fives.
Eights to fives. Okay.
Want to buy a place?
We'll compromise with you at six.
One of the things, too, I think we're doing is a political correct exercise is your committee of moving all the numbers up, and then the line progressively goes up higher too. So we haven't done anything, but we've sounded good while we're doing it.
No, I think we've sounded good, and that's why I'm highlighting some of the things to moving them, and I'll go back. But I am sensitive to that, and I think Karen was here just a few minutes ago. I got some information back from OYA and things and other people about a kind of blended piece. So. But like I said before, I think we can put them in within varying scopes. But so I'm going to highlight that. I'll go back and look at that. Other sevens,
Mr.
Senator Devlin.
Where's probation and parole in this?
Adult is a number eight, I believe.
Adult is a number eight.
Yes, community supervision. Mm-hmm. At the top of page four.
Would it be more consistent to put it as about a seven in the sense of, particularly on the nature of probation, the idea of probation is supposed to be that the person is relatively high risk. Eight seems rather low, actually.
But I guess I have seven as 1145 incarceration, so we wouldn't even be locking them up if we weren't able to fund to seven. So that's why I put it. I mean, I'd be willing to move it to seven, but seven's going to get awfully muddled pretty quick.
But that's probably true in terms of probation, that most people would be, 1145 or less. But in terms of parole, they could be very serious offenders, depending upon where you put parole.
I think we should break this one up. I'd be willing to move parole. I'm happy to move parole up.
Yeah.
Not put parole and probation together, but I know, I mean, there's been a work group that's been working on savings regarding 1145, and part of what we've talked about is kind of single sanction kinds of
I can agree with that.
So they, so that's where we're at. So we will move the parole piece. We will move the parole piece up. I won't do it right now because it'll be ugly and messy. But okay. Other sevens.
Mr. Chair, we haven't yet heard corrections, but do you know how much they were considering as they were talking about, so far as resources utilization, how much they were talking about expending on out-of-state sanctions, incarceration out-of-state? Do we know what that figure might be?
Yeah. Claudia?
Mr. Chair, first of all, you need to pass a bill that's sitting somewhere in committee to provide authority to provide for out-of-state, and their population management plan does not include, even at this time, any out-of-state rentals. It does, toward the end of the biennium, anticipate rental of county jail beds where available. Okay. But no out-of-state at this time.
So that would accomplish what I was questioning about the 1145. Extended sentences could be held in counties, and renting the beds, in effect.
Potentially, yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Other sevens. Sixes.
Representative Hansen. The two tobacco task force items I look at as totally revenue items, and I don't know how relevant they are in terms of even being on the list, other than you got to put them someplace. But I've gotten listed as fours because I'm confident they generate more general fund dollars than they're getting cost. I've also got the criminal major crimes child abuse as a three, and the criminal major crimes homicide person crimes is a three.
Other thoughts on tobacco?
I'd like to see some of the results before you start moving those way up the list, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, note on tobacco task force, keep in mind that this funds two legs of the stool. The third stool, state police, is not funded at this time. Whether or not you add those funds or take the two sides that you have here and blend it to get the third leg funded.
68 is the third. On my list five, 68.
What's that?
Well, I thought 65 is Department of Justice piece and 68 the Oregon State Police piece.
There is no money specifically for tobacco, the tobacco task force right now in the state police budget. Only in, I'm sorry. There is no money in the state police that's listed here. I'm sorry. The other one I was thinking was revenue, and that is funded.
I'm going to highlight DOJ and OSP because I put them both there because they're tobacco task force. You put the major crimes and major crimes, homicide and person crimes. Where did you put those, Representative Hans?
Both as threes.
Okay. Well, I think most of those would be Measure 11 types of crimes at this kind of level that the state police get involved with. So I'm okay with moving both of those. Other people? Anything else on six? Fives? Do you have anything else on six, Senator Devlin? Go back and look. We're on five now. We moved OSP up to threes for both major crimes.
Chairman, I think I'll be satisfied with that.
Okay. Fives? Fours?
Okay. Okay. Just, Mr. Chairman,
Yes.
I was just wondering about the chair's reasoning behind forensics crime scene versus forensics analysis. One is a 5, one is a 3.
Yeah, I see it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if crime scene analysis...
I think the analysis stuff was general. I guess the crimes... The reason I broke them up into two issues, I think, was the lab analysis in of itself that's there, that happens in the... at the labs in and of themselves. The other is the crime scene analysis. You know, a lot of jurisdictions pay to have their, already can do their own, most of the major jurisdictions can do their own crime scene analysis. It's a lot of the smaller jurisdictions that can't do their crime scene analysis. I'm willing to move both those up to be parallel issues, but I broke them out because there was a question as to, you know, people had raised issues about who pays and what's reasonable and what's not. So that, I think that that's the only reason I broke those two out.
Either making parallel or make the first one that you have as a 3 and the other one as a 4. What I wanted to be assured of in terms of analysis is I know that in many cases local jurisdictions would have that capability. I just would not want us in the cases particularly of major crimes, particularly major person crimes, where jurisdictions may not have that capability, that OSP still be available in terms of their forensics capabilities in terms of crime scenes in those cases. So a 3 and a 4 would be...
So if we... So do you want to move them to 3?
That would be fine.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On the 5s, I've got the SWAT bomb squad rated much higher as an 8, and that was based on the relationship patrol. If patrol's not in the picture, I don't know how viable it is to be able to assemble the SWAT team. And then I ranked arson investigation and crime scenes both as 3s. And I think the arson investigations, again, is I rated some 3s based on their impact on what other law enforcement agencies can do. And I don't, I think you need the arson investigators to be able to work with the rest of the local law enforcement communities.
Okay. So how about if we put arson investigations as a 3? Everyone okay with that? And I guess I make some distinction, though I don't think it's a great distinction at all, between the SWAT, MRT, and those kinds of items. They are substantial officer safety issues. I might even rank them higher than actually you rank them as we continue to cull the list and cull the list and cull the list. So I'm going to highlight this one and come back and take a look at it.
And the other major deviation, and this one I'll probably take a lot of heat for, but the supplements for district attorneys I rated as an 8.
Okay.
And the rationalization for that is that it's general fund dollars that's going to local government, which is usually something I really support. On the other hand, at least in this area, the local governments have control of their district attorney budget. So if they want to fund it, they can. We're not forcing them to fund something that they have no control over, and they've got an element of control over.
All right. So now we have two things at number 5, but we'll keep going. Well, I highlighted that, and I'll come back and take a look at that, and I think your argument is good. Okay, 4s. Representative Hansen.
Well, just a concern on the parole board. I've got, if it's constitutional, I got ranked as a 1. Again.
Oh, we're at 4s.
Oh, there's a patrol on parole
item
board. 54.
Mm-hmm. Oh, parole board here.
That's a notification issue.
And the Constitution says that what is ever practicable at the time. And I don't know what's... That's why I put what is practicable on the side.
Good point.
The basic functions of the poll board are a level 3 on this one.
Okay. Any other things at items number 4? Item number 3.
Oh,
I can't get much higher than...
I'm sorry. On the 4s, I've got dignitary protection ranked a little lower than that.
Okay. What do you have dignitary protection ranked?
8.
All right. We will highlight that particular piece. We'll ask the governor to come testify on that.
He's a Marine. He can handle it.
All right. Any other things on 4s? 3s? Okay. 2s? Ones.
All right. Mr. Chair, just so we've had this discussion, under 1 you have a number of program items with corrections and to a certain extent OYA. In reality, many of those are constitutionally required, but if you cut the number of prisoners in a prison further down the list, you won't need as much money up there. The constitutionality follows the prison.
I think what Doug's trying to do right now is price these as to the program level, as to what it costs, as to the administration of the various programs. So that we have a better understanding, and then what's constitutionally or statutory required as a result of it. We should have that done by Monday, and so we'll bring that back to the committee with some dollars, just so people can do it. Also, like the committee members to think a little bit about what's going to go on. I'm going to bring a memo Monday that says to send to the co-chairs that basically says, you know, we realize the dire crisis we're in right now, but we believe that it would be reasonable that we will work diligently to find X amount in the public safety budget, which we believe is reasonable based upon our current hearings to date, but that we also have some gaps to fill, which we're, I think, all well aware of in regards to the governor's shortchanging $1,145, as well as the court to some degree. I'm not going to pick exact figures, but we will identify that we believe there's a hole there, and so that the co-chairs know what at least the committee feels as they finalize their co-chairs budget. So I'm going to bring a draft of that Monday and let the committee look at that and then send it off. All right. Thanks, everyone, for staying late. With that, we're adjourned.